Good evening. In this segment, we're going to continue our examination of the profound influence of the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy milieu, including the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, later a key element of what came to be known as the World Anti-Communist League, the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, or ABN, essentially a renaming and reconstitution of the Committee of Subjugated Nations, a consortium of Central and Eastern European fascists that was put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943 and then simply survived into the post-World War II period, where it became a profound influence not only in German politics, but American politics and in world politics as well. In our previous two segments, we've not only been examining the profound tilt towards Croatia, and that tilt being political and media-wise. There's a profound anti-Serbian bend to our media coverage of the conflict in the former Yugoslavia. This is not to say, as I've said before, and as I will emphasize again, that the Serbs are blameless in that conflict. Indeed, there have been atrocities and horrors to go around, many of them obviously committed by the Serbs, but they were not the forces that started this war, and indeed they have not been the only ones to commit ethnic cleansing. And one of the forces, as we have seen, that has been driving the Serbs in the direction they have been going is a very clear historical memory of the slaughter they endured at the hands of the Ustashi, the brutal Croatian fascists who allied with Nazi Germany in World War II. The exact figures on the number of Serbs who were ethnically cleansed in World War II varies. The figure 700,000 is frequently seen. One will also see figures ranging from 300,000 to 500,000. It really depends on whether combat deaths are factored in and a number of other things. Beware of accounts, revisionist accounts from the pro-fascist elements that as few as 60,000 or 70,000 Serbs were killed. Not that that would be a day at the beach, but those figures are way too low. Figures as high as 700,000, also figures in the 300,000 to 500,000 range, are considered viable, depending on what source one consults. Again, I've quoted the 700,000 figure in these programs. One will see figures ranging from 300,000, 450,000 to 500,000. In any event, there was a great deal of ethnic cleansing of Serbs at the hands of the Ustashi, the brutal Croatian fascists who allied with the Third Reich in World War II, and who essentially survived intact and underground, both within the bowels of the Reinhard Gehlen milieu and within the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. They also, as we saw in our last segment, became a key element of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council. These Croatian fascists, along with other Central and Eastern European fascists and Nazi collaborators, many of them war criminals, were imported into the United States at the end of World War II in a program that was brokered by Alan Dulles, overseen by Richard Nixon. One of the spokespersons for one of the major elements of this program, the Office of Policy Coordination, was Ronald Reagan. The individual who actually handled the State Department machinations to bring these individuals in when the State Department switched from the Red Cross as the vehicle for their importation was William Casey, later, of course, Ronald Reagan's campaign director and CIA and director of the Central Intelligence Agency. George Bush himself, both when he was head of the Republican chairman of the Republican National Committee, later when he was head of the CIA, and later as vice president and president, was deeply involved with this same milieu. We've dealt with this in various programs, the aforementioned Miscellaneous Archive series, or aforementioned in the last segment, Miscellaneous Archive show entitled Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign. We've also dealt with that in the September 6th, 1992 installment of Radio Free America number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. And indeed, as we have seen not only in Radio Free America shows 14 and 15 dealing with the World Anti-Communist League, but also, especially, in Radio Free America program number 36, a program dealing with the destabilization of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe under the Reagan and Bush administrations, the influence of elements like the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, the Republican Ethnic Heritage Outreach Council, involving elements such as Laszlo Pastor, Ustashi elements, Romanian Iron Guard elements, many of the residual fascist and Nazi elements that we incorporated at the end of World War II. Those elements wielded a profound influence on the Reagan and Bush White Houses. They not only were involved with people like Ronald Reagan and George Bush and William Casey and Richard Nixon when they were in some of their earlier political incarnations in their early 50s, and later, but also when they achieved the pinnacle of power. Indeed, the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and related elements had virtually an open door at the Reagan and Bush White Houses, and they figured prominently in both the conceptualization and actual execution of policy towards Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Again, and I will give you the address, etc., for this later in the program, the aforementioned Archives on Audio, a tape duplication service which has all of these archive shows, including the various archive shows that I've already cited, on permanent file. Before leaving the subject of the Croatian fascists, the Ustashi, and again, the influence of the Croatian fascists on not only the Republican Party, but specifically on people like Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, and the national security establishment itself, in particular the influence that this entire Eastern European fascist milieu wielded in the Reagan and Bush White Houses couldn't be exaggerated and had much to do with formulating the policies which Bill Clinton basically has been carrying on in sort of a political manifestation of inertia. Essentially, the policy direction towards that part of the world was pretty clearly established when Bill Clinton took office. I do not think he is blameless in this situation. He certainly has not done much to reverse American policy in that part of the world. However, I'm not sure that there's a heck of a lot he could have done given the direction that those policies were headed in. Note also that this same milieu, the same ABN, Croatian Ustashi, Romanian Iron Guard, Hungarian Arrow Cross milieu, is also very, very influential in Germany, and they intersect with the Nazi and fascist elements which exist in Germany today and which were never effectively purged at the institutional level in the Cold War period. Again, in numerous archive shows, I have dealt with the failure of denazification because of the anti-communist and anti-labor stance of the Third Reich. The Nazis were deemed useful in the Cold War period. By way of understanding, though, just how contemporary the influence of the Ustashi fascists is in contemporary America, and they are quite widespread and far more effectively distributed and disseminated than one might suppose, we're going to listen to a short segment of a program which was broadcast on KKUP-FM. KKUP is a small listener-sponsored progressive radio station in the South San Francisco Bay Area. And for a period of time in the late 1980s, there was a Croatian radio program hosted by a fellow named Ante Jukovcevic, who, at least as of recently, was hosting a Croatian television program distributed to a number of community access cable TV stations that were run out of community colleges. This program was called the Croatian Radio Hour, and it involved a mixture of Croatian music and also announcements about political events. Now, recall that in the last segment we dealt with the concern within the Republican Party over not becoming too closely affiliated with the April 10th holiday that was celebrated by pro-Ustashi elements here in the United States. It celebrates April 10th because that is the anniversary of the German invasion of Yugoslavia in World War II. It is a day of mourning for the various other Yugoslav nationalities because, or former Yugoslav nationalities, because that is the day when the slaughter began. However, the Ustashi and related elements have continued to celebrate April 10th as a holiday in the post-World War II period. What we're going to listen to now is about a five-minute segment of the Ante Jakovcevic's Croatian Radio Hour from April 6th of 1989 as broadcast on KKUP, and you're going to listen to not only his explanation of Croatian nationalism, but his promotion of the April 10th holiday as a day to be celebrated by Croatian separatists. That is the Ustashi pro-Nazi holiday. It celebrates the anniversary of the German invasion of Yugoslavia, or as Ante put it in his rather creative approach, when Germany was invited into Yugoslavia. The following was broadcast on non-commercial station KKUP-FM in Northern California on April 6, 1989.
And we got another call from Jan Bakotic, and he asked us what we know about coming event in the Croatian church on the Sunday. He received a flyer, and what is about that? So, and And coming Sunday, it's not a church celebration, it's a celebration by Meju Drushtveni Odbor, Sjeverne Kalifornije. And this will be April 10th, which is a day when was established independent state of Croatia. And I will give a little more history later, but to answer question to Mr. Jan, it's going to be mass and will be program after that with the group Knez Branimir and Tamburica Kral Tomislav, and for dancing we'll play with Dubrovnik. So that's about this group that are organized, are all groups, political groups together that celebrate that political date that was independent state of Croatia. And 1918 was established first Yugoslavia, and then after that, in that period, was Kingdom of Slovenia, Croatia, and Serbia. And of course, during that period, was people there were not happy with that situation in Yugoslavia. Was not freedom, was not national freedom for anybody who was not Serbian, and because was in general Serbians in power. So what was people that call, what call history as control Serbian hegemony. That's what call, if you ask Slovenian and Croatians about that. So when Germany was invited Yugoslavia was capitulate in and break in 6-7 days, and that time was a form independent state of Croatia, and also in another Croatia before that was in Austro-Hungary monarchy for many years, and before 1918 was in Austro-Hungary monarchy, and then when Austro-Hungary monarchy was break, then was established that first Yugoslavia and Kingdom of Slovenia, Croatians and Serbians, but king was a Serbian king, and so of course he was ruling in his way. So then when Germany was invited at that first Yugoslavia, then Yugoslavia break in the part and was independent state of Croatia was established. And that state was for 4 years, and then during that period was another part of people that got together and they were fighting against this state, and the Croatian people were split in two. One were defending this state of Croatia, and another were fighting with communists for another Yugoslavia with President Tito. And so that was after 4 years was established second Yugoslavia with President Tito. And so people and organization, political organization, who support independent state of Croatia, then celebrate this date. And so that's what is Mr. Jan all about.
That again broadcast on KKUP-FM, a progressive listener-sponsored non-commercial station in Northern California on April 6, 1989. A rather creative and original view of Yugoslavian history. Note again the couching of the Ustashi movement in the context of an anti-communist, democratic independence movement. It was anti-communist, and that's about it. Note also his interesting phraseology when he refers to Germany having been invited into Yugoslavia. Germany was no more invited into Yugoslavia than they were invited into Greece, Albania, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, the Soviet Union, or the other places that they wound up. Again, this by way of illustrating the degree of cultural as well as political infiltration of these elements in the United States. That has much to do with the pro-Croatian and anti-Serbian bias that we have been covering. During the last part of the segment, we are once again going to turn our attention to the influence of this Galen ABN-related milieu, a milieu that figures prominently in the various archive shows that I've done over the years, we're going to look at the influence of this milieu once again on the policy of the Reagan and Bush administrations towards Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. However, we're now going to turn our attention to, I guess one could say, American Ostpolitik, as it applied not only to Poland in the Cold War, but in turn as we're going to turn our attention to how that affected the Vatican, and also how the Pan-Turkist movement, a movement that originally sought to ally itself with the Third Reich in order to regain lost territories inside of what used to be the Soviet Union, that same movement survived in the post-World War II period and has evidentiary tributaries running in the direction not only of what used to be West Germany, but also the United States, the U.S. intelligence system, and also the aforementioned anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. And the Pan-Turkist movement, too, figures prominently in the background and at the foundation level of elements of the Cold War policy that this country pursued in the Reagan and Bush years. One of the most important archive series that is available from Archives on Audio is the series about the shooting of the Pope, including Radio Free America 17, dealing with fascism and the Vatican, including the very close relationship between the Vatican and the Ustashi in Croatia during World War II, and the role of Croatian fascists in establishing the Vatican Rat Line to help Nazi war criminals escape, many of them to Latin America and many of them to the services of U.S. intelligence. In that series, we dealt with the Propaganda Due Lodge, a Masonic lodge headed up by former Mussolini fascist and Waffen-SS officer Vito Gelli, an honored guest at numerous inaugurations, including Ronald Reagan's. The aforementioned Vito Gelli in the P2 Lodge functioned as what, in effect, could be viewed as a crypto-fascist government that ran Italy. It had participation by major organized crime figures in Italy, major military figures, major intelligence officers, former Italian fascists who had worked under Mussolini, and later the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, and the Alleanza Nazionale, the successors to the Mussolini fascists. The P2 Lodge also involved powerful political figures, many of the most powerful political figures on the Italian scene, also industrialists, financiers, and journalists as well. As such, it in effect was able to wield virtually decisive power over Italy throughout much of the Cold War period. And indeed, the P2 Lodge figures prominently in the machinations around the Vatican Bank and the financial scandals that have plagued the Vatican Bank, about which we're going to have more to say in a minute. The P2 Lodge weaves in and out of the story of who shot the Pope. Indeed, what we're going to be doing during the last part of this segment and as we progress with these segments is not only presenting some new information that's come to light about the circumstances surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul II, but also we're going to review some of the information from the past. Because indeed, although the American media establishment made that crime out to be the work of the Soviet bloc, in fact, the available evidence suggests that the shooting of Pope John Paul II was a provocation, and that the Pope was shot by Nazi and fascist elements associated with Western intelligence, some elements of U.S. intelligence in particular. Indeed, the same milieu that we looked at in our segments evolving from the Office of Policy Coordination and the Nixon-Dulles program to settle Nazi war criminals in the United States for political purposes. We watched that milieu evolve up through the presidential administrations of Richard Nixon and then right on up into the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Again, Radio Free America 36, Radio Free America 37, the Pope shooting series 17 through 21, and Radio Free America programs 14 and 15 are some of the central titles dealing with the evolution of this milieu. The aforementioned Radio Free America series 17 through 21 deals with the role of this milieu in the shooting of Pope John Paul II in May of 1981, not the Soviet bloc crime it was represented as being, but almost certainly a provocation and an act committed by Nazi and fascist elements working for and with Western intelligence. We're going to have more about that to say in coming segments. The following article was researched for us by Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator. Dave got this from the Corriere della Sera of Wednesday, August 23rd of 1995. Some major figures that figure in the scenario surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul II are discussed here. In addition to Mehmet Ali Agha, the self-confessed a shooter of the Pope, himself a member of the Grey Wolves, the youth wing of the National Action or National Movement Party, a pan-Turkist and explicitly fascist party whose genesis goes back to the period of World War II when it was sympathetic to the Third Reich. Its evolution goes right up into the contemporary period with large elements of it working with NATO, the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, and also the BND, what used to be West German, now German intelligence, the successor organization to the Reinhard Galen spy outfit. We're also going to hear about Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the head of the Vatican Bank, the IOR. The Vatican Bank, a scandal-plagued bank that had two P2 members, Roberto Calvi and Michele Sindona, as members. The Vatican Bank apparently involved in channeling funds to anti-communist activities. The Vatican Bank deeply involved with corruption, deeply involved with some of the machinations that involve the shooting, that weave in and out of the shooting of Pope John Paul II. We're also going to hear about Francesco Pazienza, an individual who apparently, and we covered him in Radio Free America number 21, we dealt with Marcinkus in Radio Free America number 18 primarily. We dealt with Francesco Pazienza in Radio Free America number 21, Western intelligence connections to the shooting of the Pope. Francesco Pazienza, another intimate of the P2 and another intimate of Western intelligence and the Reagan and Bush administrations, who appears to have played a role in attempting to get Mehmet Ali Agha to implicate the Bulgarians in the shooting of the Pope. This article reads as follows again, researched and translated for us by Dave White. This from the Corriere della Sera of Wednesday, August 23rd of 1995. Sometime in the next few weeks, Adele, Rondo, and Rosario Priori, the magistrates investigating the disappearance of Emanuela Orlandi and the attack on the Pope, will be in the United States to obtain an interview with Monsignor Paul Marcinkus, the president of IOR from 71 through 89. That's the Institute per l'Opera dei Religiosi, the Vatican Bank. Orlandi is the daughter of a Vatican employee who vanished in June of 1983. The judges will most likely ask the prelate whether he was acquainted in the past with the businessman Francesco Pazienza. According to Pazienza's former right-hand man, Alvaro Giardelli, there were in fact numerous telephone conversations between Pazienza and Marcinkus during which the Monsignor asked the businessman several times to follow the Agha case closely. Furthermore, Pazienza's name was brought up again by Agha on July 26th, when the Turk was transferred from Montecuto prison in Ancona to Rome for yet another interrogation by the two magistrates. On that occasion, the papal attacker talked about the visitors he'd had in jail. He said even Pazienza came to see him, and that the businessman had asked him to, quote, come up with the Eastern Bloc trail as an excuse, unquote. In exchange, he would be extradited to South America, perhaps to face lesser drug charges, or even freed outright. Agha, who spent the last 14 years behind bars, could soon obtain semi-liberty. Well, again, it'll be interesting to see what these two magistrates have to say after they speak with Paul Marcinkus, again an American of Lithuanian extraction, and among the many, many connections of this ABN Galen milieu that we looked at was the effort on the part of the Reagan and Bush administrations to tease Lithuania away from the former Soviet Union. We looked at that in Radio Free America 36, and in a supplement to Radio Free America 36, the destabilization of the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe, we took a look at the role of the Vatican, and the Pope and Archbishop Marcinkus, the Knights of Malta, something else that we talked about in Radio Free America number 21, in working with the Reagan and Bush administrations to support solidarity and to destabilize the former Warsaw Bloc, or Warsaw Pact. Again, Poland, a key element of that. In the aforementioned Radio Free America number 21, we took a look at the apparent meetings between Mehmet Ali Agha and Pazienza. Agha claims that Pazienza indeed helped to instruct him about various things to do to get out of prison. The allegation is maintained in this particular article that apparently Pazienza was also working very closely with the Lithuanian-American Archbishop Marcinkus, head of the Vatican Bank, the scandal-plagued Vatican Bank, the ill-fated Pope John Paul I was very likely going to open up that investigation into the P2 and Vatican financial scandals. However, he never got a chance to do that. He died under rather strange circumstances in a matter of days and was replaced by Pope John Paul II, an individual with many interesting connections, including the Opus Dei lay order within the Vatican, an organization that has its genesis with people who were supportive of Francisco Franco's fascist regime in Spain. Indeed, the Opus Dei outfit overlapped heavily with Franco's administration. Indeed, the Pope himself brought some rather strange people in to help straighten out the Vatican banking Vatican banking scandals, including an arch-reactionary named Felipe de Vec, with connections running in the direction of the World Anti-Communist League, and also Hermann Abs, chairman emeritus of the Deutsche Bank and one of the primary financiers of the Third Reich, and one of the a member of the board of directors of IG Farben. As another officer of the Deutsche Bank commented when learning that Abs had been brought in to straighten out the Vatican finances, the Pope, quote, "The Pope has made the goat his gardener." One of the things that we looked at in Radio Free America number 21 was that even though the Pope was anti-communist and a Polish nationalist and very supportive of the Solidarity Union, which got funds, according to a number of sources, from the Vatican Bank, the Pope also did not want to see a war start in Poland. He did not want to see the Soviet Union invade Poland. That obviously would have been extremely destructive to his native country. And that particular element, as well as a common interest in limiting the spread of nuclear weapons and in achieving diplomatic recognition for the PLO, formed those common elements formed the basis for a diplomatic rapprochement, which was underway when the Pope was shot in May of 1981. For all of their differences, the Vatican and the Soviet Union were effecting something of a diplomatic rapprochement to avoid war in Poland, among other things. It was at this time that the Pope was shot by an individual who was affiliated with the youth wing of a Turkish Nazi organization, basically, the National Movement Party, or National Action Party. Turkey, of course, a NATO country. We also noted at this time that there was a great deal of movement on the Italian intelligence and covert political scene. We're going to take up that movement and delve further into an examination of the circumstances surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul II in upcoming segments. Again, the evidentiary tributaries run strongly in the direction of Western intelligence and explicitly Nazi and fascist elements associated with it, and indeed some of the elements that we were looking at in connection with the Croatian situation, such as the ABN and the former World Anti-Communist League, will also crop up in the context of our investigation. All of the archive shows that I have referred to are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. The name of that duplication service is Archives on Audio. They can be contacted at area code 415-346-1840. I would also note that there's a 20-page catalog available which lists all of the archive shows and cross-references them with other programs containing similar or related material. That program list and the descriptions and cross-references is available on the webpage for KFJC-FM, the home base station on which I record these broadcasts. More about that right now.
Attention, fellow humans wielding exquisitely different and stylish pocket protectors. Please be so inclined to now access those devices, for soon pertinent information will be divulged. Your oh-so-local Silicon Valley cutting-edge broadcasting station, KFJC 89.7 on your FM unit, is now accessible via the World Wide Web. Isn't that just so convenient? This URL goes as follows. http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC. Once again, all in lowercase letters and for clarification, that is http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC. Check it out.
That, again, the information for the World Wide Web page for KFJC-FM, the station in Northern California on which I record these programs. That concludes this segment. In our next segment, we're going to continue our examination of Western intelligence connections to the shooting of Pope John Paul II. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.